You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
This episode of On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Brand Now, How to Stand Out in a Crowded, Distracted World. Many former On Brand guests are already raving about Brand Now. Jay Baer calls it the quintessential guide to modern branding. Stacey Grissom of BarkBox says Brand Now provides practical tools and a helpful framework for building a brand both online and off. Learn more, get special extras and additional resources at brandnowbook.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Heidi Grant. Heidi is a social psychologist who researches, writes, and speaks about the science of motivation. She is the author of Reinforcements, How to Get People to Help You. Her previous books include Succeed, 9 Things Successful People Do Differently, Focus, and the 8 Motivational Challenges. She is Global Director of Research and Development at the NeuroLeadership Institute. She continues to serve as Associate Director of Columbia's Motivation Science Center, and in that capacity now teaches executive education courses on topics related to her books. She received her PhD in social psychology from Columbia University. Heidi, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you so much for having me, Nick.
A return guest to the On Brand podcast, no less. This is amazing.
That's right.
And another new book that, mm-hmm. We were talking a bit about this before we hit record. And for those listening that usually listen to our chats on branding and digital marketing, you could say, wait, what's all of this social science funnery that we've signed up for this week? But it's the host's privilege, and this stuff fascinates me. But I also think it is marketing adjacent when you talk mm-hmm. about motivation, when you talk about your last book, which I love, No One Understands You, and What to Do About It, because I think that's really, in a roundabout way, the business that we're in. How's that for shoehorning what you do?
I think it works. I think it works because at the end of the day, it is about how do you get people to do things? And some of that is, with the last book, it was really about how do you influence people in part by understanding how you're actually coming across. And that often we all fall victim to this thing psychologists call the illusion of transparency, that we feel like when we're communicating, whether it's in person or any other format, that our thoughts and our feelings and our intentions in particular are really clear to other people. And you only really have to look at sort of any marketing mishap to see that that's really not the case. Often the intention behind something is absolutely misread by the perceiver. And that book was really about how common that is, really how difficult it is to understand the intention behind a communication or someone's behavior. That really, it's kind of amazing that we understand each other at all. And certainly to influence people, it's helpful to know a little bit about how that perception works and how you can be a little bit more reliable. This book is kind of along the same vein, but here it's really about how do you get people to support you, to help you, or to do sort of pro-social things, right? Things that they feel are about the welfare of others or for the benefit of others. So that includes movements of all kinds, getting people to participate or be a part of, you know, communities of various kinds? How do you get people to act not just in their own self-interest, but in the interest of others? And a lot of, again, you know, both books for me, I love those places where our intuitions about how to do something are just terrible. Where we kind of think like, you know, this will really appeal to people, or people will see this way, or this will really get people to want to be a part of my movement or to support me. I mean, but, you know, the reality is everybody needs support in every kind of work we do. We all need the support and help and collaboration of others. So it's like, how do I get people to do that? And sometimes our intuitions are just so bad. And that's where the science can be helpful, because it can show us, you know, by explaining a little bit about how brains work, a little bit about how people work, we can get a hold of some strategies that are more effective than the ones we sort of think will help and end up not helping so much.
And at that point, I think that any marketers listening should have probably perked up and are into the game if they weren't there already, because that's getting people to act, getting people to do something. And I mean, to me, I think that's especially when you talk about marketing communications and getting someone to do something. And so many times we're so close to what we're working on, and we think that the ask is that simple, that someone will just want to jump in and, right, you know, support our cause, or learn more or submit a form or something. And there's a whole lot more to it than that.
There really is, because there's a lot of sort of inertia that you're having to overcome. In the book, I talk a lot about how, the idea of, you know, and again, especially, you know, in the book, I'm really focusing a lot on when people engage in a behavior that they think is about, in some way being a part of something bigger than themselves. Right. So, where you're kind of appealing to their better nature, for them to want to engage in something. And again, this is useful. You know, everybody listening to this, in addition to being interested in marketing, is also sort of interested in their own personal, success in their own careers, right? And so it's sort of useful on both scores to think about, how do I get, you know, everybody has networks, for example, and everybody, you know, and like, Lord, there are a lot of books on networking, some really good ones, in fact. David Berkus was a friend of, I think, of both of ours, has a new book out called Friend of a Friend. That's great. And so there's lots and lots of guidance out there on how to network well, how to get past, you know, the icky feelings that are involved in networking. We all know we need these resources, but I think there's less guidance around how to actually take advantage of the network you have, because that's actually an additional step, right? I can make all of these connections. I can have all of these alliances. I can connect with people. But then when I actually have to get them to do something, that's actually another step beyond that. And it's a different set of skills and strategies that are required to make that rewarding for the person. And that's, I think, that's really important, that what the research is really clear on is it's not the hardest thing in the world to get somebody to help you. It really isn't. In fact, actually, that's something I spend a lot of the book talking about, is that people actually want to help. They want to do pro-social things. They want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. There's a lot that's rewarding. And in general, people are more likely to do that than we think they are. A lot more likely. Like, we underestimate it by about half. But it has to be rewarding. It has to give them the warm glow. You know, it has to give them the good feels, or they're not going to do it again. And so a lot of times I think what happens is people either don't know how to approach others to get them to do something, or get someone in their network, let's say, to help them in some way. They're hesitant to do it. They approach it in a way that kind of makes it weird, and the person isn't helpful. There's lots of ways to make it weird, by the way. Or, you know, they do it and the person helps them, but frankly, they don't find it rewarding to do the thing. And so they're not going to want to do it again. So the book is really about, in a way, how to make this a win-win thing, where I get you to do something that I need you to do, but you end up feeling great about the fact that you did it. And that actually just strengthens the relationship between us and the connection between us, rather than, you know, I get you to do something, you kind of reluctantly do it, and then you kind of want to avoid me. you know, after right. that really yeah. never helped me again, which is, you know, what happens to a lot of us. Right. So the book is really kind of about identifying all those places where there's sort of common misconceptions or things we do that we think will be helpful, but actually aren't. And how to make it rewarding for everyone. Again, like being anything that is framed as an opportunity to help another person or to be a part of something bigger is going to be naturally motivating to human beings. We're just, the vast majority of us are just wired that way. So it's really about how to capitalize on that, really for everyone's benefit.
Framed as an opportunity to help others. It sounds simple. So that kind of begs the follow-up question. What are we getting so damn wrong?
Oh, so many things. Where
See,
do I
you
start?
Asked if you could swear beforehand. I just, yeah, I went there. I went there for
exactly,
you.
Exactly. I'll probably come up with a few of my own. So I think first and foremost, again, the first part of the book, I really spend a lot of time unpacking why we don't solicit support and help as much as we should be doing it. Like I said, we all need help. We all need support. We all need people to do things. We all need to move people in various ways. In fact, when I first talked about the idea of this book with my editor at HBR, she said, you know, getting people to do things is and help and be supportive is really kind of what management is, right? Like in a nutshell, right? I mean, we all have choices. We all have options. And even if it's someone's job to help you, they don't have to give you their best help. They don't have to make you their top priority, right? We all have ways of prioritizing things and deciding how much effort we're going to put into something. So, you know, if you want to be somebody's top priority, if you want to get the best effort out of them, what do you do? Well, the first thing is understanding that you're actually, again, if you're making what psychologists call pro-social appeals, right? Appeals that are about, you know, helping others or, that are part of something, again, bigger than yourself. You have a lot on your side already going for you because people are just wired innately to want to do these things. It's part of our evolutionary like DNA. Human beings are not formidable creatures, right? We don't have claws. We don't have fangs. We're not very big. We're not very strong compared to lots of other mammals, certainly our primate cousins. And so the way we survived is, you know, over the history of human existence is by banding together. And we're really good at that, you know, and human beings survive in groups. And so we're really like our brains evolved to be just acutely sensitive to the social, and to want to contribute to the welfare of the group, to which we belong. It's just part of our nature. And we're also very acutely aware of when we're about to get kicked out of the band as well, because that like that's like imminent death, right? So we're very sensitive to exclusion, we're very sensitive to rejection. But the feelings of belongingness and helpfulness are kind of wired, you know, into our DNA. So right from the get-go, it turns out people are much more likely to help us than we think. There's all these great studies I talk about in the book where, you know, you basically, and we torture people doing these studies because everyone hates asking for help. But so you basically take people who are in the experiment and you say, you have to go up to strangers and ask them for favors. And the favors are relatively innocuous. You know, it's fill out a questionnaire or can I borrow your cell phone or something like that. But people hate it. I mean, as soon as they find out what this is about, they want to run. They want to have nothing to do with asking perfect strangers for help. And then we say, well, you know, the researchers will say, well, how likely do you think people are to help you? And they'll say, you know, something like, well, I think only like 25% of the people will say yes. And then they find out that like 75% of the people actually say yes when they actually do it. But that's the nice thing about these experiments. Everyone hates it in the beginning, but they leave with this like warm glow of feeling like humanity is filled with good people because people are much more helpful than we think they're going to be. So that's sort of the first thing, like understanding, you know, the requests that we make for help from other people are actually much more likely to get yeses than we realize. And part of that's just because the costs of saying no are actually higher. People are uncomfortable saying no.
Right.
They're uncomfortable not doing the thing that they feel, you know, good people are helpful, right? So, you know, it's like if I'm a good person, I should be helpful in the situation. So that's, I think, one of the big things that we get wrong right from the get-go is we're just reluctant to ask. And we often frame things in, you know, one of the ways we kind of make it weird and ruin it for people is that we assume, again, this is where our intuitions are bad, that what people want is sort of like, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So we'll often, you know, someone will ask you for help and they'll say, hey, by the way, Nick, can you do this? Can you, you know, wash my cat for me over the weekend? You know, while I go away. And if you do, I'll give you a gift certificate to, you know, to Fridays or something. Now, what that person just did, well, like they thought like, oh, you know, if you do this for me, I'll give you this thing in return. That sounds logical, right? That sounds like something people would like. What actually happens is that people hate that.
Uh-huh.
What you just did is made it a transaction.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Also, maybe you don't like Fridays, but like, that's not the point. The point is you made it like, you made it a transaction between us rather than something that you could feel good about, right? You could feel good about doing me this kindness of watching my cat, and you could feel like, okay, I'm a good friend to Heidi. I'm going to watch her cat. But now that I offered you a gift certificate in exchange, I made it like something that would happen between strangers. And that actually feels icky and wrong and ruins the ability, you know. So I think there's a lot of times when you're trying to motivate somebody to do something for pro-social reasons and then you give them a gift, it's just sort of messed up. It's like I've never understood like the tote bag giveaway for PBS. It's like the one, you know, on the one hand, it's like you want me to, okay, you're doing the pledge drive. And, you know, I want to give to this organization that I think is so great, like public radio or public television. And then you're going to give me this kind of like crummy tote bag. And now I sort of feel, I wonder like if that's actually an intuition that's really off, that just makes people feel like it was an exchange rather than, and not even a good one, by the way, because it's not a very good tote bag, but like, you know, rather than I get to feel good about supporting an organization that does great things and that I care about. Right. So that's one of those cases where I think sometimes we think, oh, rewards are good, but rewards sometimes undermine the motivation that someone had originally, which was to be a giver, to be a helper, if that makes sense.
It does. It kind of underscores the point, everything in the answer of why it's so hard. People want to help more than we think that they do. Mm-hmm. And they're more inclined to say yes than no, because the social contract, it's hard to say no.
Right.
But we, yeah, I mean, so it's the system is built for us to, for this to go much better, but boy, do we get in the way.
We get things wrong. So that's one of the big categories I talk in the book, like taking, it's fine for something to be a transaction if that's what you were going for from the get-go. You know, here's a simple transaction. Do this for me, I'll do this for you. Okay, great. But again, if you're going for be a good person, be a part of something bigger, be a part of something that really matters. And by the way, here's this, you know, free like light, like flashlight. Now you've just sent some seriously mixed messages, right? I mean, is it about a flashlight or is it, you know, or I thought I was supposed to be a good person. Why are you giving me a flashlight? So there is this thing where sometimes we mix, more isn't always better. Piling on different kinds of motivations for people can sometimes just leave them feeling like, I don't know how I'm supposed to be motivated here. Is this about my goodness as a person? Or is this about you giving me rewards for doing the right thing? And that's one area that's confusing. Another thing that happens is that people sometimes are weirdly apologetic. nobody likes that. You know, the Amanda Palmer, the art, you know, the artist and musician, mm-hmm. talks about this in her book, The Art of Asking, that she would see this in, you know, in fellow artists who were asking for money to, you know, to support their work, that they would sometimes do this thing where they would like, I'm so sorry that I have to, I feel so terrible for asking you. And this is so uncomfortable. And I feel so bad about myself that I have to ask. And all you do is you create this horrible energy where you're actually depriving that person of the ability to feel good about helping you because you're making it super uncomfortable. So that's another way that people mess this up. They over apologize. They make it transactional. They just make it strange rather than saying like, here's what I need. And it would be really great if you would help me. You know, one of the things there's three main things that are really important for pro-social behavior, right? Behavior that's about more than just you. And then for that to be rewarding, two of them two of them, you kind of need one or the other, and then the other one you always need. So you need either to create a kind of a sense of what psychologists would call a sense of in-group. So that's very powerful, right? So you belong to, you know, this group of people who have a common identity and perhaps common goals. And we naturally, again, for all those evolutionary reasons I talked about before, we naturally want, are motivated to do things in the service for people we feel connected to. And we feel like are part of our group. And you know, a lot of people in marketing know this, right? And they will try to find ways to make people feel that connection, right? That somebody that they're you know, they could be helping is like them in some way, right? Because that's very powerful for people. We naturally want to help our own group. We're naturally less inclined to help people who are not, we don't see as being a part of our group. So that's sort of one source of motivation that you can tap into. Nick and I are both authors, and you know, I know that I've done this, and not even totally deliberately, but I realized it afterwards that I've done this. For sometimes, like, I have to ask my fellow authors for favors, right? When we have to, you know, when we go to be marketing our books, and we ask them, people like Nick, I might go to and say, hey, can I be on your podcast? And you know, you frame up the request a little bit by reminding you that you're all in the same boat, right? It's like, hey, fellow author. You know, I know you hate doing this as much as I do, but I need to ask you for a favor. And it's sort of, again, it's like that sense of like, hey, we're all in this together, right? It's a little subtle reminder to people that you kind of have the same identity. So that's one way. Another thing that's just really important is this sort of sense of positive identity that can come from like that. I'm a good person. I'm a generous person, because I'm going to engage in this activity, right? Because you know, it gives me some way to feel good about myself. It's a self-esteem boost. So either that, you know, in general, what the research find is like either that self-esteem boost, like I'm a great person because I'm doing this thing, or I'm a part of this group. Those are really potent motivations to tap into. And you can even see it in things like in like Kickstarter and like GoFundMe kinds of things, where like some of the more successful ones are cases where people feel like they belong to a group. Right, that all love this thing or support this thing, and that identity is important to them, and that's what's sort of fueling them. And then the last thing I'll say just really quickly is that effectiveness turns out to really matter. So people want to see their help land, and I feel like that's a very common mistake that people make when they're trying to motivate other people's act to action. That if I'm gonna donate to your cause, if I'm going to take a certain set of steps that you want me to take, if I'm going to buy something in order to for the greater good, I want to know how it helps people. I want to know how it's going to make a difference. And there's a lot of research that shows that appeals that are very specific are more impactful than ones that are less so. So, for example, there was one that sort of they compared the effectiveness of two appeals. One that was sort of to save the children kind of fund, where it would just, you know, generally go to saving children, but you just didn't really know exactly how your money was going to be spent. Because there's a one that was an organization that was I think called Spread the Net, I believe it was called, and it was about very specifically your money would go to buying nets that kept mosquitoes off people, so that they wouldn't get malaria and other mosquito-borne illnesses, and people donated a lot more to that one when they had the choice between the two. And what the researchers found was that people could actually picture how their money was going to be used, right? It was like going to be used in nets, you know, that was, it was very, very specific. So they could see how that would be effective. Whereas like giving to a general cause is not something where people can understand, you know, how is my helping going to have an impact? How is my behavior going to have an impact? So finding ways to help people to understand what their specific impact will be is just incredibly important for making this behavior rewarding and for motivating people to actually take action.
Well, that's, I love that example too of the generic save the children, which there are any number of ways to do and things you could give to do that versus the nets. It makes me think. I think it was Lawrence O'Donnell did something for desks for kids in another country, like school desks, and I that's great for the same reason. And the Kickstarter point, it's interesting, and you talk about seeing your impact, but also you're a part of something. There was a Kickstarter for a local documentary that someone made, and of very, very wisely, one of the top levels of giving got you a credit at the end of the movie. And
That's genius.
Yeah, I mean, all of a sudden you are at, and they again wisely made that the highest level, and it had sold out by the time I got there. I you know, probably had to get the tote bag or something. I couldn't. But that reminds me exactly of what you're saying, that I can not only see it because I've brought this into being, but I am a part of it. I am a listed club member.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, and I do think some of those prizes that are given through, so first of all, that's brilliant. I mean, you're literally as much a part of it as they can make you, which is great. And I think, and so again, you're feeling that sense of in-group. That's amazing. And that's going to be super motivating. And of course you see your name. I mean, if you feel the impact, I think that, you know, some of those prizes that they give on Kickstarter are really brilliant. I mean, because again, it feels less like an exchange and more like I'm giving you this thing that only, you know, the insiders will have. Right. And it's not a flashlight. Do you know what right. I mean? It's like something meaningful, right? That indicates your insider status as one of the people who was a contributor here. That's when the giving of something in return really works. You know, it's a meaningful thing. It's like a badge that, you know, sort of tells the world I'm a part of this group, and it strengthens that feeling of being an insider. Whereas if it's just here's this bonus thing you get, that really, it doesn't feel unique in any particular way. It doesn't give you that confer that sense of insider status. That's actually going to just work against you. It's actually going to undermine people feeling like this is a good cause to give to, because you're undermining their ability to feel good about it. So I do think the strategic use, and a lot of those campaigns are very clever about the kinds of things they give away. And that's really the goal, to create that feeling of like, I'm in the elite club. That did this. That's brilliant.
So as we unbelievably start to wrap up here, what's one thing, if you could, if you're on the elevator with someone and they say, wow, that's interesting, I would like to do better at that, is there some sort of way of thinking different in asking others to help that you would leave our audience with?
Oh yeah. Do you know, I think that the you know, and again, this is more sort of for interpersonal help, although the kind of things that each of us, everybody listening, right, needs the support and help of others. I think one really critical thing is that we tend to assume that our needs are obvious to other people, that they see it, that it's clear to them how to help. And that they would be helping if they could. And a lot of times what the research shows is that people just don't notice that you need help. It's not obvious. There's this expression, it goes without saying, that I hate, because it's just the worst expression. It's like never true. Everything goes with saying. Like everything should be said. It goes with saying. Nobody's a mind reader. And in particular, that's true when it comes to the help you need. Don't assume that even people that work next to you every day understand how overwhelmed you are, understand what they could do to lift that load, understand how they could be supportive to you. So help requests have to be explicit and they have to be specific. Tell people how they can help you. Tell people what they specifically can do. You're not bossing them around. That's actually the guidance that people want, because they want to be effective help givers. And nobody wants to offer help to somebody who doesn't want it. So it's so important for each of us to sort of, you know, put ourselves out there, say what we need, say exactly what we need and who we need it from. The data is really clear on this. The chances of getting it are far greater than we think they will be. And people really do benefit from getting to be helpers and getting to be effective helpers. So it really is a win-win. So that's the one thing I would say, you know, speak up, be explicit, be specific, and you'd be amazed at how much more help you're going to get.
Well, you've added some amazing science credentials to to what I talk about a lot in my two books. I've had chapters on community and about embracing your people power. And it goes without saying, I kid. but if a line I repeat in both books is that, and I'm glad that you've backed this up, is that people want to help you, but they often don't know how.
That's
so
right.
I love that, making sure that your requests are illicit and specific.
That's right.
Heidi, I have an illicit and specific request for you. Who is a brand that has made you smile recently?
Do you know, I am still, so I have a tendency to prefer, not surprisingly, the brands that employ comedy in various ways. I have to be honest, I still like Geico just gets me every time, especially that one with George Washington crossing the street. It just kills me. But I still watch the Tide commercials from the Super Bowl. I cannot get enough of that guy. So I think that, for me, my days are stressful and long, and the brands that can make me chuckle, I have a tremendous amount of brand loyalty to. So very grateful for that.
And I know that you like a good laugh, because you recently shared the same thing that I did, the Onion's resurrection of their hilarious take on Diamond Joe Biden.
Those jokes are, they will never not be funny. And I'm just so grateful that even though Joe is not really in the public sphere anymore, that the Diamond Joe Biden jokes just keep coming, because they are my favorite. Absolutely.
They have created a version of him that is so rich.
It's so great. And he loves it too, which of course he does, because he's terrific. So love that.
Yeah, just don't ruin his party carpet.
That's right.
Heidi, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Well, so my website is www.HeidiGrantPhD.com. The new book is out. I think it's coming out on June 12th. And as they used to say in those Dianetics commercials, it's available wherever books are sold. But my website has lots of links to lots of videos and articles and all kinds of like freely available things. If anyone's interested in learning more about this topic or just about sort of the science of motivation in general, lots to dig into there.
That is awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Heidi, thank you for joining us on Brand.
Thanks so much, Nick. Great being back.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community. And this week, I'm going to invite our community of past guests and give a shout out there. Speaking of The Onion, we had Eric Munn from The Onion on a few years ago. And I believe Joe Biden came up back then as well. So we'll link up there. Also, and a reminder, if you heard something that you liked on this episode or another, or you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. On Brand is a production of Brand Driven Digital, helping complex organizations simplify their branding and marketing to unlock growth. More, including the links we discussed on this episode, at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show, hoping that that request was both illicit and specific. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.